Here we go.
Great. Good, so let's start in. Everybody back in the Beit Midrash. We are holding on page 33A2 in the Schottenstein edition of Tractate Gittin, Talmud Bavli. And 33A2 is just where we saw, well, 33 is where we saw an argument between Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish, very famous pair in Chevruta, who presented an argument about really what are we trying to prevent with the fix, the tikkun olam of Rabban Gamliel the Elder, who said that no longer can a husband annul a get in the presence of a Beit Din that he orchestrates or he gathers in his locality. He has to do it either in front of the wife or in front of the shaliach, or send the shaliach to the shaliach, an agent whom he has given that agency. And what really were they trying to prevent him? So we said that on the matter of Tikkun Olam, we saw that there's a little bit of trying to preserve family life in general, and that philosophically that could be part of the underpinning of what we're trying to protect. And we also saw that it's trying to protect the woman in the sense that if it keeps her married, she should know it. And if not, she should know it and protect against her remarrying and being really married again out of wedlock, even if that was the only thing we were trying to prevent. We could prevent another level, and that is we tried to prevent mamzerim, illegitimate children, from that new marriage. So that was an argument, and being that it was an argument and we had both opinions brought forward, we really see that it's all about both. We talked about the notion of a Talmudic argument presenting two positions in order for us to understand that there could very well be both issues at hand, and in this case it's a design that the editors use to create a sense of, let's look at the big picture. Let's look at all sides of the issues. Let's look beyond just one approach. I said at the outset of reading their machloket, their discussion, that one time we would go back to Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish to investigate who they were. Tonight we won't do that, but we will down the line a little bit. A very famous pair who had many disagreements, and Rabbi Yochanan valued Reish Lakish as not only someone with whom to talk about Torah, but really who would challenge his Torah. And he came to express that in the Gemara, and there was just such a love affair. And of course we mentioned that he, Reish Lakish, married Rabbi Yochanan's sister, and it was definitely, you know, familial and in the family, and maybe part of that was at bay when they were really discussing these matters to begin with in terms of protections. But on the societal level, Rabban Gamliel the Elder had a son named Rabbi Shimon. And we're going to see today a piece of text that Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel opines about, this law of the Beit Din and what can happen if someone still believes that you should be able to convene a Beit Din and cancel the get, or cancel the agency of a get, when his father, Rabban Gamliel the Elder, already made the new law that doesn't fly anymore. Mm-hmm. What happens if we say that retroactively that law or that custom or that legal process of going and convening your own Beit Din really still is an effective legal method of canceling the get? And we're not only going to see that tikkun olam in that sense, that the principle of creating a just society or making sure that we protect the interests of the weak, we're going to see that it's not only about the question of the wife's status, but that it's a little bit more expansive, not only about family matters, but they're going to ask the question internally in the Gemara, how much authority do we really want to give the rabbis, and how is that going to manifest? And can the rabbis really be the ones to really make a fix on the world? Is there a rabbi at one time who legislates, and then we consistently and must forever abide by that rabbi's law? Or is there a mechanism, and is there a general approach that we can use, that the rabbis can use, to continue to fix what they see as unfolding problems? What's the authority of the Beit Din? The Beit Din that, in their opinion, creates the legislation that's necessary for the continued fixing of the world. So the introduction in this Mishnah of the principle Tikkun Olam becomes the question of how do we consistently fix the problems that are going to arise within the framework of marriage? And does it only have to be the way that Rabban Gamliel the Elder fixed it? Or does the Beit Din have a different kind of power to fix these problems? And in that sense, again, they are interested in protecting a woman, protecting the family values that we talked about on the more philosophical basis, and also getting into the issue of, well, what if it's a rabbinic court that legislates something that supposedly fixes a matter? Do we have to go back to the original fix, or can the rabbis in that day really legislate? That, I think, is at the core of some of the text that's going to be a very short text that we'll look at now, and we'll try to flesh out all those meanings as we look at it. Okay, so we're on 33A2, left-hand side of the page, if you're following along in the translation. The Gemara is going to cite a Braita. Remember that a Braita is a text that is, one, left on the cutting room floor, if you will, or at least is set aside and not part of the Mishnah proper, and it's from the age of the Tanaim. We're talking about 1st, 2nd century at least CE, maybe a little older than that in terms of these Braitas. So the Tanu Rabbanan, the rabbis taught in a Braita. Bitlu. If the husband, what's the point here? Nullified the get before a court, not according to the way that Rabban Gamliel the Elder said he should do it. What's that way?
Not to do it.
Rabban Gamliel the Elder made a new law. The new law was what in terms of canceling a get?
You either had to deliver it yourself or send an agent.
You either had to go to the wife yourself or go to the agent or send an agent to cancel the get. That's Rabban Gamliel the Elder's Tikkun Olam. That's his takana. That's his new law. In the past, what did they do before that? This was part of the Mishnah. They convened a Beit Din. Whether the Beit Din was two people, whether it was three, we looked at that text. Doesn't matter right now. We're talking about a legal process to actually cancel it. What if, with the new law that Rabban Gamliel the Elder passed, I still convened my local Beit Din and I used that method to cancel it? Mevutal divrei Rebbe. Then Rebbe says it's canceled. Meaning what? Even though the law of Rabban Gamliel the Elder was the new law that I had to arrive at the wife's house, I had to go and really talk about this with the agent, or I had to send an agent to the agent. If I still did it, I'm going to say, no, I'm sorry, it's void. That's Rebbe. Now remember that Rebbe is the third generation. He's the representation of the third generation here. First I have Gamliel the Elder. Then I have Shimon ben Gamliel. And then I have Rebbe. Mishpacha. What?
I think a Rebbe was Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel's grandson. Rabbi Gamliel that we're talking about here is the elder. He lived at the time of the temple. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel was his son. And then, I believe, Rebbe might have been his grandson. Am I right?
Rebbe is the grandson of...
Of Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel.
No, of Gamliel the elder. So that's how I understand it.
Yeah, okay.
So Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel says the following. I don't agree with Rebbe. Eino yachol lo levatlo. The husband can neither void the get, the lo lehosif al tina'o, nor add to his previously stipulated conditions. Meaning what? The husband could, in a certain sense, say, this get will be valid if such and such occurs. Or if, something along the lines of a condition like, you see here, if the wife doesn't drink wine for 30 days is written down in the note. There are other conditions that were put into gets so that they could take effect X number of days later. Whether or not that's actually, again, divorce abuse, I'll use that term, we haven't used that term yet. We're guarding against divorce abuse. Recalcitrant husbands who would say and tease a woman with a get in terms of freeing her to get married to somebody else. So some conditions seem to be a little harder than others. Why did they put in a condition about the drinking, that she shouldn't drink in 30 days? So one positive outlook in that vein, commentary on this commentary that I once saw, was that she should know in sobriety that the get was delivered, and that, in fact, the get is kosher, and there was a problem potentially with drinking. Is it a projection of his own problem and what he thought might be happening? We don't know, but interesting discussions go on when people get together in different circles to study text. And Amy, for many years, and myself for a few, were involved with Torah learning within the Jax community, which is a Jewish alcoholics and chemical dependent network of people who come together for Shabbos and come together for different learning and all kinds of wonderful exploration of their Judaism in terms of it bringing a certain strengthening to the table for the recovery process. And this kind of discussion, when these kind of matters come up, really is a reflection of people being really thoughtful about how Jewish legal life is impacted by the diseases or choices that people are experiencing and the kind of hope for sobriety that's within the texts just may indeed be the angle that is represented here. Not sure. Can't be sure. Anyhow, Shimon ben Gamliel is saying, look, if you're going to allow the baiting to come together to nullify the get, you've uprooted the elder's law. How can you allow that to happen? She'im Cain, if it were effective for him to do so, in spite of the decree to come and nullify this get in front of the beitin, or with a beitin that he organizes, ma koach beitin yafeh. What good is the power of a beitin? So that question in and of itself is a question that could be asked not only in the context of the get and the delivery of the get, but is a contextual, rabbinic, cultural question. If I allow for the position of Rebbe, generations after Gamliel the Elder, to come and say, no, I want to go back to the way we used to do something and legislate that, what good is the power of a beit din. But what's the problem with that? We know that a beit din,
there's a lot of them.
We know that
it does a lot more than this one.
It does a lot more than this one thing. And we're talking about, in general, the whole premise of Bat Hedin, all the stuff they do. So if I know from the Torah that it says the judges in your day shall have power and you shouldn't steer right or left from them, if you remember this portion in Deuteronomy, and I know that I give a certain power to the judges in any given time period, and they are going to act upon their feelings about what is best for society at any given moment, why should I not be able to say that their take on the law, their take on the process, is absolutely as valid as Gamaliel the Elder's back in the first generation? And if they want to reinstitute the convening of the local Beit Din for the nullification of this get, why shouldn't I allow it?
Because it's a jurisdictional issue, not an authority issue.
How so?
They don't have jurisdiction if, in fact, the elder's law is in effect.
Well, the question would be, in terms of the whole process that's unfolding in the Gemara at this stage, who does have jurisdiction?
Well, I'm just saying, if you accept the elders, then it's not saying that that Beit Din did anything wrong. It's just saying it never had jurisdiction, so it's irrelevant.
Okay, you could go that direction.
But I thought what you're doing now is expanding and making this more obtainable, because now you could have both routes for it. I didn't know that it was one or the other. I thought it was, even if they didn't do the agency, if they had the Beit Din, you could also do it. So this way it means that your problem was that you weren't able to get the information, it wasn't done in due time and all of that. So if you add this vehicle, because
right,
somebody wants to do it that way, then you're saying you can either do it this way, you can do it this way, and therefore there's two ways to do it. But they seem to feel as though, and this was a specific problem in terms of the notification. It didn't have to do with the whole concept that the Beit Din was wrong. It had to do with the fact that in practicality they were not really getting the information in a timely way. Right?
Yeah, I mean, we posited, like the commentary on the Gemara said, that the reason why there was such a dilemma in the first case is because they wouldn't get the information out. There was no report. There was no newspaper.
It didn't seem, when we read it that way, that they were questioning the authority or the need for the Beit Din. They were questioning the practicality of it and adding a different way that was
right,
going to get around
right,
that.
Right. Let's go back to that, though, that if that is the position. Because we've talked about how...
I'm just saying it could...
No, no, we've
so
talked about how discussions could expand on possibilities and add to the power of the people, right? And we could have empowered the husband to go nullify this get, and we could have also kept the power of the husband to have a Beit Din, right? And this could be the moment where, in the text, we turn and we say, hey, look, the third generation really feels like there needs to be both ways. This could be that moment, based on what we're going to read next, which I'm not bringing into the picture yet. We are going to see that, in fact, this is an open door to them asking the question. I'll get to you in a moment. This is going to be the open door for them to consider yet another way to make sure that the marriage system and the divorce system works the way they want it to.
Okay?
So whereas the get, if there's a Beit Din convened locally, is going to be canceled, but we're going to hold that Gamaliel the Elder's new law doesn't allow me to do that, therefore the get's still valid, right? And that get is going to get delivered. Now it's going to be delivered, and what's going to happen? It is
valid.
Going...
Valid.
What's that?
It will be valid.
Yeah, and it will be valid, and it will work, right? Maybe there's going to be a discussion about, well, but if you're saying as Beit Din and as a rabbi that in fact that's legal and that's your real opinion, how do I fix that? And I just don't say, well, you should have used Gamaliel the Elder's way. I got to now fix this again. And I got to figure out how to fix this again. We're going to see in a minute they're going to figure out how to fix this again. So there is another way that comes up. It's just not another way to actually nullify it. if there's another way to actually fix the same problem that Gamaliel the Elder was trying to fix to begin with. Okay. Tim?
Well, there is a premise in the Talmud that the earlier generations had superiority over the latter generations, especially in the Tanaitic period. So the question would be, how could Rebbe overturn something that happened generations earlier? Unless, the Talmud says, his Beit Din is greater in wisdom and in numbers.
Yeah. You know what I call that? I call that Tosafistic learning.
Yeah.
If you apply
the approach.
But it's not the Talmudic approach here. What we're doing is we're staying true to text. And so it's very true that that's a Talmudic principle, and that's very much valid by way of the Beit Midrash, how to learn this issue, right, in terms of Talmudic parlance. Oh, maybe this is the principle of the Beit Din Elyon or the Beit Din Rishon. The first earlier Beit Din has more power than the later Beit Din, and that's the issue at hand here. But it doesn't really say that. Right, I'm dealing with more like a pashat of the Gemara, the simple sense of the Gemara, and that is the internal discussion between these three, among these three, and I'm not really clear that that's the issue. I could agree with you that that is applicable if I read the entire corpus of Gemara, but what I'm interested in is in this sugya, and this discussion in this small piece of text, and I'm wondering whether or not. A, they're aware of that. That could be really what's at stake here. Or C, there's some workout before that principle got designed based on who these people are in this case.
A second problem that I see is that generally a rabbinic group can't overturn a Torah law unless they're doing it b'shevi al pasa. Here they're actually abrogating a get, which would be they're taking an action. That never happens.
Okay, so what Penny's saying is that there's a legal principle where a later rabbinic group comes and says, I'm going to not implement that law. Sheva al tase. I'm not going to really do that which was legislated by the earlier court, and therefore, in effect, I've revised the legal opinion. And here they're not doing that.
If it's doing
here they're actually going back to what in the Mishnah was a practice beforehand, right? That's a very interesting reality here. And that's why the discussion for me seems very early. Like this brighter reflects a very early stage of what's going on to figure out how the Beit Din's power is going to work. And the authority of later authority figures is going to work. So that's why I think it's all tied up in there. Was there another hand?
Yeah, we're back to the issue of enforcement, though. If she's got it in her hand already, and he's going to a Beit Din simultaneously because the messenger has delivered it to her. She's now has a piece of paper is null and void, but she doesn't know it, and no one she shows it to knows it. So this looks to me like a prescription for catastrophe.
Right. It is catastrophe, and that's what Gamaliel the Elder was fixing. And that's why they want to still keep it on the fix, on the mend. They want to fix this problem. And that they just can't get back to this, letting this Beit Din be the way they do it. So let's read the next little piece here and see if that clears the air in terms of their commitment to their fix. So the Gemara answers, can there be such a thing that from a biblical standpoint the get is void? In other words, the biblical standpoint here, what's Mideraita here from the Torah? It's actually a recognition that the power of a Beit Din is indeed Torah-itic. The power of a Beit Din, if I convene a Beit Din, to me sounds like, hey, by Torah law, I've really nullified this piece of legislation or this document. It has no legal validity. If you're telling me that a standard procedure that we have at a Beit Din that nullified this thing is actually not going to still be in effect because of a new rule that Gamaliel the Elder made? Are you really saying that that's the case? Makoch Beit Din Yafei Shevinan Eshet Ishlam? What good's the power of the court? That's the reason you're going to hold this, that there's a court of Gamaliel the Elder that made a new law? You're going to say new piece of legislation really is that much more powerful than by the Torah's mandate that a Beit Din should be recognized and what we do at a Beit Din should be the rule of the land? We're going to permit a married woman to the world at large? In other words, that get is going to be delivered? And sorry, no, it's not valid. That's the challenge of the Gemara. In other words, the Gemara sees for a moment here that it's got to challenge this and say, but didn't we say that from the Torah standpoint, that convening of Beit Din is really the way that we Jews do business? You know, that even if you tell me there's a new rule, you're going to permit this woman when in fact that get was nullified. That get is no good anymore. Just to say that the Beit Din of Gamliel Yeller had that power? So the premise here is what really is Torah? The question here is what is really Torah? If Midaraita, the Beit Din, is at work and then does its business, and even if I have a new rule about it, that's really the nullification. When I have a Beit Din, even if I got a new rule, first of all, that's a really interesting interpretation of what Midaraita Torah law really is. Because if I open the Chumash, and we read the verses the first week we were together, is there a description, Midaraita, as in the Torah itself, of the process that I use to actually write a get, nullify a get? No. So we see, and this is how we say it with deep respect and love for our rabbis, we see that Midaraita is systemic production of Torah law based on open doors to such systems within the Torah itself. Because what was the part of the Torah? Systemic production of law based on open doors in the Torah, based on the reality that we take one verse or one word or one situation in Torah and create systemic law with it. So what did we see in the Torah that allowed us to start formulating laws about writing gets to begin with? That you hand her a what? What was it called? A Sefer Kritzut. It was this document that cut the relationship. But there was no laws about writing it. There were no laws about delivering it. In fact, the agency piece is still what interests us. What is this whole agency business really all about? How far can an agent really go for me in my life? Today we're going to do some of those sources after we finish up this little piece and talk about agency in general. That's a really interesting piece of this. The deraita challenge here is to say, but wait a minute, we created Torah law and we created a Beit Din system that's supposed to be the system, and if Rebbe says that this guy who organized the Beit Din had a Beit Din really cancel it, you can't tell me that the rule that I'm supposed to follow that the Mishnah says is Tikkun Olam is the rule that I'm supposed to follow if it's going to permit a woman who is really married to get remarried and have children. The Gemara answers, in. Yeah, I'm really saying that the power of Rabban Gamliel the Elder's Beit Din is indeed the power we're going to go with. The new rule is the new rule. And also I'm going to tell you that a Beit Din can really have such power in general when it's a Beit Din that we see as a Beit Din in good standing and not an old way of convening a Beit Din in the face of a new rule where there was now, let's say,
jurisdiction.
Because called in the Kaddish Adata, the Rabbanan Mekaddish, anybody who gets married actually marries a woman according to the laws of Moses. And here the statement is as playful as ever, but as holy as ever. We do recognize the power and the legislation of the rabbis and can discuss which generation has the power versus which generation may not abrogate those laws. And we do say that, in fact, they must follow our rules. And if, by the way, they don't follow the rules, what can we do? And if they don't follow the rules, I can even have what's called hafka'at kedushin. I can even nullify the original betrothal, the original marriage, and say, since this guy didn't follow the rules of the divorce, I actually just consider the marriage to begin with null and void. And I permit her to get remarried, what? What's the chiddush? Without a get. She doesn't even need a get anymore.
So what's the case of her children if she was never married?
Then she's fine. She can marry a Kohen.
No, she's
they're not Mamzerim. She can marry a Kohen. She's not divorced.
She had children from the first marriage. From
the, oh, the children from the first marriage. Oh, that's a very interesting question.
So they're causing a different problem.
Right, so then...
years behind Henry VIII.
Yeah.
So we really do have lots of discussion about that. I'm not prepared to go into all the discussion about status with those children. However, let's just say that some people really feel that they're given a status of standard Jews in the world. People, like, they're called Anshei Ba'alma. Some people feel like we need to call them then children who were born out of wedlock and give them moms their status. It's a very interesting debate. I don't feel like I have read every case to tell you what all the answers have been. What's interesting is that in some of the cases we know about such a matter when there's no mitzvah of pru or vu, of be fruitful and multiply, that was achieved by the couple in question. In other words, the mitzvah of be fruitful and multiply, which requires a couple to have one child, and they ultimately get to a place where it's interpreted that you have one son and one daughter. And by the way, the Gemara says in another place that if you're a person who's taught anybody, then they're like your children. And in a very spiritual sense, they're able to perform the mitzvah of pru or vu. It's very nice Gemara and very modern commentaries that really bring out that spiritual sense of that Gemara. But if they didn't achieve this, this was one of the main reasons why people ultimately found another spouse and why divorces were effectuated. So there you have this very, very interesting discussion of...
They didn't have children, is that what you said?
Yeah, because they couldn't achieve having children. Mm-hmm. And so that was a crisis for, you know, many times the couple, and that led to such matters as to live in separate parts and find another wife, and then what do we do about the get, and what do we do, you know, all these questions. So
awful. Nobody thinks that's awful. That's awful.
I would say that sometimes in current, it is kind of awful. It's sad. Sometimes it happens in modern times that people come and they're really, really troubled that their marriage didn't work the way they wanted to.
I understand that.
They're pressured to do it. If they chose to stay together, I think that you can find in certain rabbinic sources reasons within our sensibilities to say that we understand that certain people didn't have children and they were either teachers or they just didn't have children. There are communities that absolutely pressure people to remarry if they do not have children.
That's what happens when they get rid of handmaidens.
There are.
Bring back handmaidens.
And by the way, that's not just a Jewish practice.
No. It's a universal practice.
Yes. That's and especially within royals, yeah, and especially within...
I get it, but I'm just saying.
Yeah,
you know,
it's troubling.
Basically, the woman is put out to pasture. I mean, no one says she's going to be able to have children with the next husband.
No, but he may not, it may be his problem.
I know, but I think for the most part, in the old days, people probably assumed it was the female.
Oh, they did assume that.
And I don't think it was...
By the way, yes and no. There are women who got remarried and tales are told of their having children afterwards.
Of course, sure, because
it was his problem.
Yeah.
But I don't think in a modern sense it was, there was tension and it eroded the marriage because
right.
they weren't, it was,
that's
everybody
what I'm trying
thinks
to say.
They don't have children and I'm trying another woman because it's your fault.
Right, that's what
children.
I'm trying
was
to say.
Not such a kindly joint thing. It was much more, you know, the power of the get, and it was the man doesn't have children, therefore he can divorce and he can find another woman. So
I once sat with people talking about this issue.
Right.
Right. I once sat with people who were talking about this issue, and right. So you can read it like that. I will say that I don't only look at it that way. I do think that giving the benefit of the doubt to some people and the pain that it caused them, that they did go through whatever, you know, I'm not saying they went to marriage counselors and sat in offices like today. We have counselors and genetic counselors and to figure out and what have, oh, we have different tools today. But I do think that throughout history this has been written up through our sources as a painful issue. A painful issue. And it's not just that she was put out to pasture by everyone. I can see that there are husbands who are absolute jerks. And I would use stronger language if I wasn't being recorded. But it's, there is an element of human suffering in it as well. That's all.
In the Talmudic time, the couple didn't need to divorce. He married a second wife and had a child. She wasn't put out to pasture. They remained married, possibly happily married, and he had a child with
him. Yeah. We've talked about monogamy versus polygamy here in historical context. We know that, in fact, and we're going to see a piece of text where it does come up, that there was more than one wife.
The story of Abraham and Sarah and Agar.
You can go back to Torah, you can go to Talmudic times. I wanted to show this to you that's in our chapter. In general, most historians are convinced that it was a monogamous community.
It wasn't practiced much.
And we said in terms of the Gemara, there's an instance of one Chacham who has more than one wife. And we also said that in different lands, up until Rabbeinu Gershom in 1000, Rabbeinu Gershom said, sorry, no more than one wife as a matter of law for all of Ashkenaz.
For European Jewry.
Yeah, for European Jewry. So this is a discussion. But we're going to see that, in fact, the assumption that one could have more than one wife is actually in the Gemara, because we're going to turn to a piece of text after we learn about Shlichu. Okay? So let's go there. I want to talk about this agency question before we go any further. Because it's a little interesting to me, this whole question of marriage and divorce, and that we can use agents to do this.
Well, it must have come out of the scribes. And that's what seems to me a very clear origin for it, because very few people could read or write. So you needed agents, and the agents were the few learned people who could read and write. And
yeah. There's one sense... Can you take one and pass it along? There's one sense that I believe it was Rabbi Galinkin once shared with us, that this is about the culture of literacy, and those people who could read the documents carried the documents.
Right.
There's another, though, position that said not everybody who carried the documents actually read the documents, and that they witnessed the writing thereof, but not that they read them.
Did so they have to have their seal on it then,
no,
too?
No. They just had to witness that they saw it being written. So I can't really say that I know, and that there's not necessarily absolute laws for who is and who's not a shaliach. We don't really have.
You still have all those concepts, though. If you're getting a divorce, you get a divorce lawyer. You don't.
How many went around?
Contract.
Did you get one?
She stopped, yeah.
Okay, so I think I put enough. This is just a collection of sources about shalichim that starts with a piece from the Mishnah in Kiddushin. And I just wanted you to see a variety of sources about shlichut and about the questions of agency in our tradition, right? Because we've been talking about something that, of course, there is agency for, that is divorce. Question, can you get married through an agent?
Well, we just had it in the Parsha with Abraham and Eliezer.
Well, for finding a wife, anyway. But no, here...
But Yitzhak takes her, so that's...
That's right, I mean, yeah.
According to the Talmud, he marries Rivka.
So we're gonna go with the fact that that is Midrashic. Right. But here is the law. Here is the law. And it says in Kiddushin. So Ha'ish Mekadesh Bo Uvishlucho. A man may marry himself or through a shaliach. Okay? And a woman, Ha'isha Mekadeshet Ba Uvishlucha. And a woman may get married herself or through a shaliach. So you can have an agent,
not two agents,
with another agent, and actually affect a marriage.
You can have the two agents getting married.
Now that's not very romantic.
But didn't people do that even our grandparents' time, where they would send over to Europe, and a woman would be married by an agent and then brought to.
Right. So there is a rich history of marriages, not necessarily in the framework of romance. We have to understand that the framework of romance, so ultimately being together in private, would for some authorities ultimately consummate the marriage, but as long as there's exchange in our tradition of the object of value, then you have a legal marriage. You have a legal marriage. And this was an important concept within the entirety of Jewish law from the time of the Mishnah. The Gemara says, once the Mishnah has permitted a shaliach, why does it have to teach about the person themselves? Right? Just asking a very interesting question. By the way, if I can marry with a shaliach, I can have an agent, and both parties can have an agent. Do I even need to say aloud that I can do it, or the agent can do it? Because if my agent can do it, I might not even have to waste my breath teaching it otherwise. Rav Yosef says, oh, but listen, it's a mitzvah, bo yoter mi v'shlucho. It's a bigger mitzvah to actually do it yourself, more than a shaliach. The ki hadra safra, as Rav Safra would what? Machrich Reisha Rava Malach Shivuta or Shibuta. It says on in terms of the Sabbath that Rav Safra would roast the meat and Rava would salt the fish. Now, remember we learned chapter 16 of Shabbat, and there were all those wonderful meals and the menus were there for us. We actually, you know, could see what we're supposed to be eating on the Sabbath. You recall that? I recall that. I don't know. Maybe I just have a deeper food focus than a lot of people. I don't know. But this shibuta, by the way, they said it's fish. It's a very unique and tasty fish. You know, I like to think of it as my own version of Chilean sea bass. You know? Yeah.
Actually, I think the Gemara says that shibuta tasted like pig.
Well,
and
that's definitely one comment.
And how did they know? I guess the non-Jew told them, and they said that anything that the Torah bans, you had available to you in a kosher way, and that was the shibuta.
You want to hear a funny thing? Yeah, so there are some people who obviously eat in these restaurants that are completely vegetarian, right, and completely vegan. And some have heksher, and some have this kind of heksher versus that kind of heksher, and some just are totally vegan, and the chefs and everybody is very happy to talk with you about all the ingredients and how everything is 100% vegan, and it's like even more Haredi than Haredi. It's more ultra-Orthodox than ultra-Orthodox, some of these vegan restaurants. So, you know, I feel good about a lot of these places. Turns out that I went to the one that has Hashgacha, has Kashrut certificate. Over, anybody ever eat at Vino?
Vino's gone.
Here's the news of the night.
Yeah.
Too bad. Anyway, they had this.
It was always so crowded. You couldn't even get in there.
Gone. I lived right there. I walked there.
Too bad. Because they had a. This is all like soy cheese and cashew cheese or whatever, but bacon, cheese, whatever kind of sandwich, whatever you call the vegetable patty, but for them it was a bacon cheeseburger. Yeah. So I'm eating it, and one day I'm sitting with, you know, my kids are there, and Shia and Zeev, wow, this is really amazing. They've never had a day in their life a taste of anything. So somebody says next to them, oh, this tastes exactly like the real thing. And now their real thing for bacon
is tempeh bacon that goes on a bacon cheeseburger. Well, what used to be, you know. I guess the.
But could you explain? I don't understand how this shaliach has to do with the roast meat.
Okay, right. So I'm going to explain it.
It makes no sense whatsoever.
Because they did it themselves.
Yes, but that's comparative to marriage. Roasting the meat is comparative to marriage.
So,
it's absurd.
So, here's the way that they see it.
It's an analogy.
Here's the analogy for them. Sabbath is like being a bride to God, or God is the bride and we are the groom, depending on which way you want to go. Some of the Kabbalah professors who talk about the, you know, erasure of gender lines always like to challenge the classroom and say, you're the bride, God's the groom. Feel okay? You know, to everybody, to all the Jews. So, anyway, this is a notion that there's a marriage here. Shabbos is a marriage. And this coming together of the Jewish people and God as bride and groom, should it be done by shaliach? Should I send somebody to go sing Kabbalat Shabbat for me in the shul? You know, I brought up the question this Yom Kippur. Should we send the robot? Let's program the robot to go sing. If my robot, by the way, that's going to be so empathetic and so functional in the world, is going to actually go and, God forbid, do this, or can, in all glory of technology, do that. Should I just send the shaliach? Whole different concept of law, right? That robots will one day, you know, that that's a question today in philosophy classes for undergrads. You know, what if a robot goes and murders someone? Is it the robot's fault?
But it's against the whole laws of robots.
Or is it
the programmer?
Or is it the programmer? Or is it the owner of the machine? Now, this
it's
is
no different than a drone.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Which is going on right now.
This is a personal level, so I'm not getting into I'm not getting into drones and the question. But this is like when you have a personal home robot.
If a drone landed in the tennis stadium during the U.S. Open, if the drone had hurt somebody, fortunately it didn't. Yeah. It's the fault of the owner.
Amazon wasn't just delivering new tennis balls.
No.
But the president of the United States has said
the question, Diane, this question is going on today in classrooms. Yeah. Question is, who really is at fault for that? Is it the manufacturer? Because remember that Product Safety Commission says that certain producers of products are actually at fault. Even if you happen to put the seed in wrong, there are major laws and protections under the law about how you can sue somebody for it being, you know, a faulty kind of product.
It's correct, as long as you don't deal with guns. Guns, it doesn't matter.
Getting back to our sugya, the question really is about this Shabbos preparation and the upcoming marriage, whether or not these great sages should be involved themselves. The Rambam, in this vein, actually codifies and says that for Shabbat preparations on a Friday, Adam mechaber et beito. A person, regardless of his status, should go home and help with the housework, with the preparations for the Sabbath, with the cleanup, with the cooking, all of this. So that really becomes a very, very symbolic, powerfully symbolic, maybe you want to call it ad absurdum, maybe you want to call it the rabbinic mindset, the culture of Sabbath and prep as being this beautiful kind of way of expressing that you are going to do this yourself. And when it comes to a shaliach, the point is that it's a mitzvah to do it, but you can still do it through an agent. And you really can be set for what is coming in life and the law you need to follow. And in this case, the wedding, if you do it through an agent. Now, Rashi, on the spot, is just about the Sabbath. We're going to skip over it. I'm interested in this question of what the Gemara ultimately says about a shaliach, being that the question originally from Rav Yosef, from the Stam, the Gemara, was, wait a minute, why would I even need to mention the person, him or herself, if in fact the agent can do it, and I know that the person, him or herself, is the person who provides the agency or who hires the agency of the shaliach. Because it says there in the Gemara, Shlucho shel adam kamoto. The agent of a person is indeed considered himself like an agent. I mean, a person's agent is considered like himself. That if I hire an agent, it's like, it's me. It's an extension of my hands, my heart, my mind. I wanted to ask the lawyers in the crowd, is that in fact American law today? And in medical terms, because I didn't know this either, is appointing an agent for my decisions like me? Or is it some other status? I don't know if anybody knows in the room.
Yeah, well, I can tell you, in medicine, it's very clear. The agent's responsibility is not to make the agent's judgment. The agent's responsibility is to answer based on what they think the individual would have chosen. So it's substituted judgment. It's not the agent's judgment. It doesn't count at all.
Play this out for me, for if you can. I come back. I come to. I heal a little. And I heard what the agent did.
Right.
And I am appalled. How could that person have done this and said this? Because when we talked about this, here are my notes, and this is not the direction I ever wanted. And what happens then?
Well, then there might be a civil action by the
between
person against the agent for failure to perform if there was evidence that they clearly went against their expressed wishes. And I'm not a lawyer, so I can't answer that part. But I can be very clear in medicine, it's not the agent making their best judgment, it's the agent putting themselves into the position of the individual and answering as if they were doing their best to represent what the individual would have wanted.
But
I just went through all this, and but it's for us, it was like, it's like a lifetime thing. Usually you appoint someone who really knows you well.
That's the hope, right?
But it's also written. It's, you know.
Yeah, but I think all the line items, there are like 50 line items that you decide.
No, there are no line items. It just says Charlie Spielholz is making these decisions for Sharon Seiler, signed Sharon Seiler. It's very simple.
So, yeah, you would hope. And I guess I'm interested in just the ramifications under the law of if the person would really be, you know, accounted for as the individual in that moment. Sorry, there's no recourse even in civil courts because you signed this, or we would allow for recourse.
I mean, we did have a couple of, it was a do not resuscitate order at every hospital we dealt with.
Right, right. You had these other orders.
And there was
that expressed her wishes.
Antibiotics and another,
right.
But basically,
You were empowered.
Yeah.
But she had expressed her wishes, and it was in writing.
Right. So that case.
Not much.
I get it.
But it doesn't have to be there. I mean, at least the last time I did, there were two separate documents. One is, in essence, an appointment of the agent, and you can execute a separate document that it just explains what your wishes are.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the explanation could lead the person to stay on track.
It's very thin, though.
But the purpose of the agent makes the decision that the agent thinks the person who's the incapacitated person would have made.
Right.
But the purpose of the agency, the other purpose of the agency is not just to carry out the wishes of the principal, but also to allow people who were trying to take care of the principal to act without being conflicted.
Right. Right. And so.
And if there is no appointed agent in New York, there's a whole list of people that you go down. So the purpose is not just to carry out the wishes of the principal, mm-hmm. but to allow.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that's what allows for it, right?
But wait a minute. I'm not sure exactly what the legal distinction is. It's been too many years since I looked at any of this stuff. In healthcare, we call it a healthcare proxy.
Yeah, that's the
issue. If you're going to vote shares of stock, proxy typically includes directions of how to execute. Mm-hmm. I believe that agency is a different thing.
But it can be limited or unlimited.
Right, it can be limited or unlimited, but, you know, for example, people have agents who negotiate contracts for them. Ultimately, the person has final authority to say yes or no, but I mean, I think agency is just fundamentally somebody acting as someone else's representative.
Mm-hmm. Henry, in real estate, good deal comes along and someone's made you an agent. Can you act without that person right now telling you, yes, please, buy that building for me?
If he gives him the money, he will buy it.
He's not like a power of attorney.
If he doesn't give him the money, he will not.
I would think the answer is the same in all fields, and it depends upon whether the person is imparting a level of discretion on you or you know, gives you certain criteria by which to make a judgment. I don't know why it would be different from field to field.
It's only different in healthcare because the person lacks the ability to articulate or to indicate in moments. So healthcare has to be considered separate from any other field. And I think once we make that distinction, it makes sense to all of us what is applicable in one place or the other.
No. I had a power of attorney on Sharon, so if she became non-compos mentis, I would be able to make all decisions if she was still alive and couldn't make it.
Right.
It was not.
That's exactly my point.
That wasn't medical, that was financial.
Yeah. No, but that's exactly my point. In that case, you are acting with your own discretion. But when a person's incapacitated, at least our system is, they're acknowledging what the person told them or indicated to them they wanted done.
Uh-huh. Or not.
Or not. No. Well, yes, right, absence right. And commission. Omission and commission. Exactly.
Right. Okay. But, so, all right. So as we explore it, if you will, look with me what this next piece of the exploration gets to. Ha'omer l'shlucho. The person says to his agent, say haro get a nefesh. Go and kill that person.
Yes.
Go and kill that person. Hu chayav vishalchav patur. The murderer is liable, and the person who sent him is not. So, how far does agency go? Definitely, I can't tell somebody to go kill somebody else. Right? So now, Shammai HaZaken Omer, Shammai the Elder quotes the prophet Haggai, the Navi Haggai, who said, Sholchav Chayav, but the person who sent the murderer is liable. Shenemar, as it said, a word that presents a verse from Tanakh, as either a proof of something or to really rely upon a halachic line of reasoning that's going to come. Oto haragta becherev b'nei Amon. That when David had Uriah sent to the front lines by his general Yoav, story of Bathsheba here, and he sends Bathsheba's husband to the front lines to be killed. You, David, killed Uriah through the sword of the Ammonites. So, what's very important is that in fact, even for the murder, the crime, the incitement is not the only punishable crime, it's the actual murder itself, if that's the thought we go with Yeller.
So are they here trying to deal with the concept of battle, of a military campaign, go kill a person? There probably was a closer connection between the person who sent someone into battle than we have today of giving them the direct command, you are going to kill anyone you see. So is this an attempt to make them, what is, from that viewpoint, what is this all about?
From that, you know.
There's a distinction here because when you say to someone to go kill someone directly, that's a first-person action. When you say to put someone in a position where they will likely be killed, well, you're not always sure of that. You're just acting there. And in the first instance, you're relieved of the responsibility. You know, for example, if I tell, you know, Judy to go and kill the next person, if she kills someone, she's liable. I'm not, because she should realize that you just don't do that.
Mm-hmm. But what if you don't have the power to say no? What if her position in society is such that she cannot refuse but to do
that's
the act
different.
For
you? You always have the ability to say no. And the consequence can be your own life.
Right. At the risk of your own.
We
can bring
that
this
ability
to any tyranny, to any fascist state, and have a discussion that way.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that to me what makes it so profoundly
complicated.
The whole discussion
about conversion and other things.
I mean, we do have the principle that there are three things that you should be killed for and not do yourself.
No, I understand.
Right?
But
one of them is to go murder somebody else. But in the context of battle and a soldier, I think the if you just went with what's here, the idea is that the soldier, him or herself, does not bear the only responsibility, though the soldier, him or herself, does bear responsibility. And that is the one who orders it, in fact, does. And that it goes to the larger principle of the strategist or the one who provides the orders. There are questions in Jewish military court of whether or not a soldier has gone above and beyond what the orders call for. And it was an interesting, there have been interesting discussions within Israeli court systems who are willing to ask this question. Have you gone beyond what the orders were in terms of nullifying or negating the threat? And that's been a very interesting part of law over the last several years in terms of Israeli law. So what's interesting is how it develops in terms of the glosses and the comments that people make. I wanted us to see some of this.
Yeah, but it doesn't say you, David, and Yoav both killed him. Because Yoav is in fact the agent who pulls the trigger equivalent by actually ordering him to the front. So here it looks as if it's not implicating the agent.
It would be an interesting mock trial one time for people to really read this text and to create a trial and put Yoav there.
But David is the one that had something to gain, and David is the one that plotted for this. I mean,
but Yoav had his position also, so he had something to gain or lose too.
Well,
right.
You know,
I mean, back to what Fred's saying. Did he have the gumption to say, I'm not doing this, and pay with his own life?
He's getting paid for doing this. This was his job.
Right.
I mean, at that time, soldiers used to get money for their tasks.
Kind of what we call military discipline.
Right. So, I mean, it's...
So, he presumably had to send some number of soldiers to the front. They were fighting a war.
Right.
And so it's not a question of are you sending soldiers, it's which soldier are you
engineering.
Sending.
And why you're choosing that one.
Right.
Not because
okay,
and
I see counsel for the defense over here. I see counsel for the defense coming up. I see the judge.
And this is not based on that particular battle.
It could be a very interesting mock trial. I'm going to keep this in mind. Let's just look at what others have said about this issue, and I think it's just as it's a fascinating issue. Okay, so the glosses of the Ramah, we're studying systemically at the end of Minyan for a long time, Rabbi Moshe Isserles. The Ramah is Rabbi Moshe Isserles. He's the great authoritative voice of Jewish law in Ashkenaz who lives in Krakow in the 1600s. And 16th century. He lives there in the 1500s. And in the 16th century, he's creating commentary to the Shulchan Aruch, which is a book of laws that's circulating. He says the following. Haggah, by the way, Hey Gimel Hey, if you're looking at the Hebrew, on the bottom of the first side of the page, that's let me make an editorial remark here. Let me add an insertion here about the Ashkenazic Jewish law on this entry from the Shulchan Aruch. And that's the beginning of his gloss. In all matters, a person's agent is considered as himself. Chutz melidvar avera, outside of a transgression, the kaimalan ein shaliach ledvar avera, because we have a general principle that we apply, and that is the principle that there is no agency for a transgression. In other words, you have the personal responsibility to not only think about this and even pay with your life, but for any avera, you have the responsibility to not be involved with a transgression. Now, where does that get a little gray, what I call sometimes studying these kinds of sources? Where does that get a little gray in quote-unquote real life? Let's forget the whole Yoav and front lines and go kill somebody. Someone doesn't tell you to go kill somebody. What's a reality, what's a case that might occur?
To do something on Shabbat by Shaliach.
Okay, so somebody asks you to do something that is a violation of the Sabbath. That's ritual law. What's another? That you don't even know. Right? Someone might ask you...
That you're unaware.
That you're unaware of something, right, that is
wrong.
Wrong.
So if you're being used by somebody. But isn't it saying that the principal doesn't have the authority to make the agency? That there's no agency.
There is basically, we nullify the fact that it was an agency. What is one case that comes up quite often in the regular workplace? I once did with some of these sources the following case.
Saying the LL security agent, the first question they ask you, has anyone given you anything to take
nice
on the flight?
So we have asked that question. What if somebody did, you lied, and then you went ahead and, God forbid, it was the wrong thing? Who's responsible then because you lied? How about this scenario? The real scenario. Came up time and again, and comes up time and again. Somebody asks you to work at a computer as part of your business if you don't own your own business. You don't know that there's no pirated software there. Right? Are you liable for using your own machine and using that pirated software? Or is it the ultimate person who's responsible? And is it the tech director? Or is
it the
owner of the machine? These are gray areas. I'm telling you, there is no 100% agreement on who's ultimately guilty. But there are averot. There are transgressions in that chain of reality. Every day that a person goes into his or her workplace. So we want to think about that. When we were in school administration, we thought through every license in our building, so we would never ask a child to transgress a licensing agreement. That was a principle within the Solomon Schechter school system.
So you weren't photocopying things?
We only photocopied things for which we had educational permission.
Yeah, there's universal copyright for education.
So some things you could, but some things you didn't. If it said on the internet, you may not distribute this.
Something because it's for educational purposes.
I didn't say that.
No.
I said there's at a university, we had universal copyright.
Yeah,
we paid for it, so I could do it.
Yeah.
I didn't file
it. You can contract for it.
Yeah. We had a contractual.
But it is true that people abuse, they think that there's a lot of freedom, if that's what you're referring to. They do think there's a lot of freedom. And in elementary schools where we didn't pay for it, we had to be extra careful. And in high schools where they don't pay for it. And in order to actually get a course reader that has the copyrights paid for, it became a big issue of whether or not you could go to a donor and ask them for such. And actually, there's a school in California who went through this and asked a few donors if they would, in fact, foot the bill for all the copyrights they needed for course readers that they wanted to put together that had articles so that the kids didn't have to buy, 17 books in the original.
Isn't that how Kinko's got started?
Is that how they got started?
I think so, yeah, because they would take care of the copyright.
That's me.
I have this all the time, because if I give a lecture and I show a slide that has an image taken from a published work, if I do that in a classroom, that's fine. But if they take that and put it on the web, it's not fine.
Mm-hmm.
So more and more places want to take your lectures and put them on the web. And I say, I'm not signing this, but if you want to get all of the copyrights for the following 18 slides, be my guest. But I'm not.
Even if it's on the web of the institution that you gave the lecture?
Yeah, so when you give the lecture, they usually ask you to sign an agreement that they can post your slides. And I say, no, I'm not signing the agreement, but if you would like to, go
ahead and
get all of the copyrights on the 18 images that are on my slides, be my guest. Mm-hmm. Then you can post it.
Right. But
until then, you can't post it.
Some places
will say, okay, which slides are like that? And I'll say slide 14, 15, and 16, and they pull them out.
Schottenstein won't allow the reproduction of any part of this, even for a study group. So I hope this didn't come from Schottenstein.
Not from Schottenstein. Except that I just want you to know that sometimes we have been in touch with Art School in our advertising the class, put out word that people should buy the book. They were okay with my photocopying, you know, one page of something. But they are very strict.
Yes.
Very strict.
One page for teaching.
I think the law allows 30 words from any paragraph to be...
Could be. Let's see how close, how much advice we got from our medieval commentaries and from the Gemara itself about this issue. The Meiri is a commentator on the Gemara, 14th century, and he says the following: Afa pisha ein shaliach b'davar avira, even though agency is not effective in areas of sin, mikol makom, nevertheless, ra'ui lehizaher shaloli grom takala shekol hagorem takala nikret hi al shamo harehu omer leDavid al maase Uriah, etc. So one has to be very careful to avoid causing another to stray for a sin that one causes is referred to as his own. Thus we find that God told David concerning Uriah, and he quotes again what we just read, that David sent Uriah to the front lines, and Yoav kills him then. And so that's bottom line, how he brings forth the Gemara to remind you in his commentary. Now, just to bring it over to Bava Metzia, Rav Sama says, where does the principle agency is not applicable concerning transgressions apply? In other words, this principle, Hecha Amarin on Ein Shaliach LeDvar Avera. So we see that in the Gemara it really was that already the principle was formulated that you really can't have an agent for anything that is a transgression. Hecha De'ibai Avid, De'ibai Lo Avid. It applies where the agent had the option to do it or not to do it. Right? Aval, Chatzer, Deval Koreche. But concerning theft, by means of a courtyard, which has no choice in the matter and is forced to be an accomplice to the crime, the one who sent them is liable. In other words,
because he was in the courtyard.
Right. So what's this courtyard scenario? There's a situation in the Gemara where you're inside one. Remember the diagram that we drew of the chet-like reality of their life.
Mm-hmm.
You have this courtyard, right?
Saving the scrolls, right?
Right. So we were saving the scrolls. So what do you think this case could be? That there's some kind of stolen property or matter of transgression within a courtyard.
Is it private or public space? Something was left there and they thought it didn't belong to someone?
You remember the case, Benny?
Well, a chatzer can acquire property. So if a thief or a person would put a piece of property in this area, the chaser would acquire the property for the owner of the property.
Exactly. So the problem is that when something becomes part of your, what's called, reshut, your legal
purview,
your property zone, and A, it could be stolen property, and then you acquire it, then you have no choice but to acquire it. The commentaries go further, and they say, what's the problem in a chaser? For Shabbat, what's the problem if I carry, back to Ron's example, of the Shabbat example, if I carry, and then I eat something for a Sabbath meal that was carried, but it was done through transgression of carrying, because I didn't set up, remember we had what was called an Eruv, and that allowed me to carry within that, now what was public space but becomes private space? I can have that problem too. So it can be ritual law. It can be property law. And I have a big problem. But I had no choice. So the one who sent him is liable.
That's what I said. Finders keepers.
Let's look at the next little piece of Gemara that I have here. Should we not say, I want to start from here, should we not say a person's agent is considered as the sender himself, and the person who sent him will be liable? Answer. In general, agency is effective. But we treat the case of damage differently because agency is ineffective concerning transgression. Now, the Gemara, I brought this forward only for the example because I want to get back to our text and do one little part back in Gittin. The idea here is that you can bring this up as a useful principle within Jewish law. And ultimately, the cases that I told you about that were gray with the software, in modern courts, this principle has been brought forward as a Jewish principle that should apply if I was found on my computer to have all kinds of pirated software that I ultimately didn't know, and that my business told me that I had to have and use, either through the tech person coming to my desk and loading me up on a computer, or the business saying, this is the software package, and even giving you a disk. Because now that we keep them on the cloud, it's a whole different story, and downloads happen differently. This is at the time that they're actually CDs that you have to load things in. So you don't know the source, but it went back to the owners most of the time versus the tech person. However, there's an argument. Why would they argue that the tech person is more guilty than the owner?
That's his job.
And that was the owner's claim, and the lawyers for the owners.
So I must ask, is it a news story yesterday and today, and you as an educator, former head of school, would probably have a response to this, where pornographic information was sent to high school students, and those
from other students,
and those students who opened those files were considered guilty of this transgression of having pornographic information. And in fact, I heard one student say, you know, you probably should have erased it and not opened it. But once they opened it, they were also considered to be part of this transgression of acquiring pornographic material.
Mm.
It was child pornography, and the problem is that a lot of people who had it are children.
Yes,
this was all in a high school. The recipients and the senders were in the same high school, and the
parents were saying those who received it should not.
So let me give you my quick answer, just based on experience of writing contracts with parents and students in day school about their use of computers. The way we would expect a child to handle any receipt of either erroneous material or suspicious material or what looks like bullying material, especially cyberbullying was on our minds, or what's called sexting as opposed to texting, is that they should immediately report it, right? Because if they delete it, the problem is that I don't have any evidence.
Right.
And bring it to the office or the technical director so that the file could be investigated by the right authority, either in the school or otherwise. We brought in, and this is in every school where I was involved, we brought in the cybersecurity and vice squad concerning bullying and sexting and sexual predators online, and had them do trainings with the middle school population particularly for these matters. It turns out that one of the world's greatest experts, I'm just going to make this kind of short, but one of the world's greatest experts is a chassid in Muncie who secretly through his life became expert at identifying people he thought needed to be hunted down by law authorities because of their predatorial status. And literally, he speaks to a few people in public, but he's part of a great network of people in the cybercrimes unit of New York State Police, and works with the Rockland County locals to make sure as deeply as possible that they're keeping their kids safe on a Jewish level as well. So, long story short, he's really an effective educator, and came in, you know, imagine, full garb, and he's the highest, biggest techie I've ever seen in my life. And all these kids were stunned that this guy could do this. Anyway, so back into our Gemara. Now that you know not to hire an agent to either kill anyone or download pirated software.
I need to cancel a few contracts. No,
good. I would give you the power to do that by Beitin in your living room.
I have a few contracts out there.
Okay. Let's turn to 33b3. If you're with just the Hebrew Gemara, I'm going to go to around three quarters down on Lamed Gimel Bet. 33b3.
So I just want to ask before we leave this, is this a support for having an agent in divorce? Because you could even have an agent in marriage. Is that?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Good to bring it all around, Bobby. You know, if I can have an agent in marriage, brings us around back to the point that it's by the law of Torah and Moses and the rabbis, and therefore, if I do it with marriage, then I can definitely do it with divorce.
Quick question. Is shaliach in this context means like a matchmaker?
No, shaliach in this context means an agent
like
who I hire. Like someone who I hire to fulfill a legal obligation that I have or a desired delivery of some legal document. An agent in that way. You might have heard also that there's such a thing as a shaliach for tzedakah. I can give you a dollar, and I can say, when you travel to Israel, please give this money on my behalf. And you do that, but I also get the credit, because it's not a transgression. It's a mitzvah. So sometimes when people travel to Israel, you'll see them give a dollar to somebody, or on any trip, in order to be safe. They think tzedakah is a nice thing. They make you an agent to do something special.
Yeah, but as long as it's less than $10,000.
$10,000, I believe.
$10,000, yeah.
Don't travel with a lot of cash. Okay.
Yeah, they will stop you for this.
I want to move on to this piece of Gemara here on 33b3, which I find a fascinating piece of Gemara just by way of some of the social history as well as what's here in terms of legislation of the Jewish people. The Gemara is recorded about Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel and his disagreements with Rebbe. Here there's a discussion of rulings, and the rulings are going to talk about issues when you have verdicts. Back to our power of the court question. The reason why I'm bringing this is because part of the social history of the Jewish people is the question of just what kind of power the courts would ultimately have, and courts in any given day. And that's going to be kind of the capper of this Mishnah before we start on the next Mishnah. Because really, I think it is about Tikkun Olam by way of the woman and by way of the marriage and the family and the children that arise out of that. But it's also the Tikkun Olam picture of the court system and what kind of power we ultimately give to the court system. And in this last case, we just saw the court could have nullified an original marriage if there was a need to really make sure that she would be free and able to marry again. So here, Amar Rav Shmuel Bar Yehuda, Rav Shmuel Bar Yehuda says the following, Shama'et minei de Rabbi Abba Tarte. I heard two rulings from Rabbi Abba concerning disputes that Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel had and that Rebbe had together. Hada karabi v'chada karaban Shimon ben Gamliel. One turned out like Rebbe, and one turned out like Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel. In other words, Rabbi Abba, and I don't think that the Gemara here, the editors, you could just say that these are stories about the individual rabbis and their names were their names. Okay? But there are ways to look at the names of the rabbis and to see within it some kind of intentionality that they're kind of using a name that would say, who's the Abba here and who's the son? Who's the Abba here and who's the grandson? Right? Which one are you going to favor? So Rabbi Abba, in this case, he chooses one ruling by Shimon ben Gamliel. And he chooses another ruling by Rebbe. And so he recognizes that different rabbis in different stages and places, it's not just the elder who's going to get the law and it's going to be passed and it's going to be held. He's going to actually have the choice of which law he goes with, or not the choice, but let's say which law was adjudicated, decided, and which one he ultimately enacted in terms of the legal precedent and in terms of the legal decision. Okay, so he says, V'lo yadana, hey karabi, v'hei karabi, anshim ben Gamliel. But I wasn't sure which position that Rabbi Abba took was really like this decision of Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel and this position of Rebbe. So I had to work it out. So Rav Yosef says, Necha ve'ana. Let's see for ourselves if we can determine from the following incident exactly what Rabbi Abba meant. Dechi ata Rav Dimi amar, for when Rav Dimi came to Babylonia from Eretz Yisrael, right, movement again between the two being very important as a matter of Talmudic culture and the establishment of the rabbinic period, he says, Ma'aseh v'asa Rabbi k'divrei chachamim. There was an incident in which Rebbe issued a verdict in accordance with the opinion of the sages. And what was that? They void a court sale of a piece of property. They void a sale based on an appraisal that's off by a sixth of the value. They void that sale. Okay? By the way, is there such a thing? Do we void sales that are off by a sixth today? Can you void a sale that's off if the appraisal is really off?
No.
Anybody ever heard that?
Who's closest?
I don't know. Probably the appraiser.
So the lender could get pretty nuts.
The lender could get pretty nuts.
No, I think the reason that they put the six is because the 1/6 is the amount that you can tolerate that it's not stealing or manipulating amount at that time. So I think that's the reason
why they put it. Amar l'panav Rabbi Prata Benoshel Rabbi Elazar Ben Prata Ben Benoshel Rabbi Parta Hagadol. In other words, lots of generations mentioned here again. How's the law going to come out? You know, is it only going to be by the first decision made, or is it going to be some kind of decision made by someone in between? Again, that's why I think that there is a dimension of this chain of tradition. I said before, Rebbe, Im kein ma koach beitin yafeh. If so, what that the court's action is void, what good is the power of the court? V'chaza Rabbi Va'asa K'Rabban Shimon Ben Gamliel, whereupon Rebbe retracted and issued a verdict in accordance with the view of Rabban Shimon Ben Gamliel, who upholds the court's action for that very reason. Right? So we ultimately can see from that Rebbe concedes to the view of Rabban Shimon Ben Gamliel that the power of Beitin, power of courts, must be upheld. And the notion that you have within the system of Jewish jurisprudence, the Beit Din that really comes to be so powerful, is in general a nod to the understanding that a court whose law, and here's what I'm going to add, seems to be working for Tikkun Olam, is the court that we're going to abide by. And therefore Tikkun Olam, as we trace its impact thematically from this chapter, is important by way of now divorce law, family issues, children's status in society, and the issues of value of property, exchange of goods, and ultimately wants for people to not be thieves. That's the expansion that we got to tonight.
I have an anecdote about Henry VIII when I was brought up. So one of the most beautiful and valuable collection of books that I don't know how many people saw it when it was at Sotheby's. I mean, unbelievable collection. There's this spectacular Talmud that was actually produced for Henry VIII. And the reason it was produced for Henry VIII was because he understood that the Jews in the Talmud had worked out how to get a divorce, and he set all of his workers to become
Talmudic experts for that specific purpose.
Okay, Rabbi, did you make an announcement about the Wednesday class before Thanksgiving?
No, I didn't.
New people, so I think it would be set it up right. We do not meet the Wednesday before Thanksgiving. Okay? It's for Shalom Bayit.
Everybody enjoy their turkey.
So for the new people, no, I just want to make sure you
or your Seitan turkey.
That's not that.
If you're talking about vegan fare.
Some people like to